This morning, we welcome back to our program Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle Clinic. He's a family practice doctor at Carle. And every once in a while, he's here, and we do these programs to give you the chance to ask health questions. Now, we do throughout the year talk from time to time with people who specialize in particular things. But the reason we have asked Dr. Jeff to do this show with us is to have a more wide open kind of opportunity to ask whatever is on your mind that has to do with health. He deals with people of all ages in his practice, with children and with grown-ups. So it can be a question for you, could be a question concerning your kids, whatever is on your mind. You can call in, and I know he'll do his best to help you out. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. Well, thanks for being here once again.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
One thing I thought maybe I might raise with you, this is something that has been in the news relatively recently, I guess, and it has to do with treatment of cholesterol, high cholesterol, that the news was that apparently within the medical community, or maybe it was specifically cardiologists or people that deal with heart disease, they decided that maybe we should get more aggressive in treating high cholesterol, which I guess would include the possibility that more people maybe should be on cholesterol-lowering medication if the other things that we believe you can do somehow don't quite do it, things like cutting down on dietary fat. And we know that exercise is important for a number of reasons, one of them being that there's the good cholesterol, there's the bad cholesterol, and doing exercise regularly is one of the few things we know can actually raise the good cholesterol. And I wonder what you think as a physician generally about this idea that maybe we ought to be tougher about treating high cholesterol.
Well, I think you raised a very good question, and you have to take sort of a much broader look at the relationship between cholesterol and heart disease. In the United States, previously, as you mentioned, the goal range was to get your cholesterol down around 200 or under if you could. But when you look at individuals worldwide, what you find out is that the average cholesterol is about 150. So the norms that had been set for the American population are, in fact, higher than what they are around the world. Mm. And this is a reflection of the American diet, which tends to be relatively high in cholesterol. So I think the change in recommendations as to what your cholesterol ideally ought to be are simply a reflection of the fact that the numbers that were used previously were high compared to the rest of the world, and the fact that in the United States, at least over the age of 40 to 45, the leading cause of death is heart disease. If you look around the world, you find the folks who have their cholesterols down in the 150 range aren't dying of heart disease. Now, everybody dies of something, so it's a question of what. But heart disease is not nearly the medical problem in other countries that it is here in the United States. Part of that is reflective of the American diet. I don't think that there's necessarily something genetically different about Americans that gives them high cholesterol levels, though in a few instances that is the case and medication is required. My experience has been that if people truly follow a low cholesterol diet, their cholesterol does indeed come down. It's mm-hmm. just that the American diet isn't a low cholesterol diet in general. Folks around the world are eating a lot more rice, vegetables, not necessarily because they want to, but that's what they have available to eat. They have perhaps other medical concerns, but heart disease isn't really one of them. So I think it'll be fairly controversial in this country, because if you lower the standards for the cholesterol level you're trying to achieve, I think most individuals who eat the American diet are going to find it very difficult to get their cholesterol down to those levels without the use of medication.
Mm. But it sounds as if you're saying that, in fact, if people really did alter their diet, it would be possible to get significant lowering of cholesterol, generally speaking, without having to go and put people on medication.
I believe that's correct. Okay. There is a small subset of individuals who have genetically inherited a form of metabolism where their cholesterol levels remain high, and they really are required to take medication in order to get their cholesterol down. Dietary modification will only bring it down so far. Mm. But that's not the typical American.
Well, so I wonder when you say that you, if we look around the world and we say that maybe cholesterol level is around 150, and here now we've been saying that in the United States, well, it's when you start getting over 200, then we're starting to get concerned. How much benefit do you think there would be to an individual, you know, say your cholesterol is 180, and maybe let's also say that on risk factors, the person's pretty good. Say you got somebody who doesn't really have a lot of history of heart disease in their family, doesn't smoke cigarettes, weights, you know, within tolerable limits. A person's not overweight, gets moderate amount of exercise, and they got a cholesterol level of 180. How much benefit would there be to a person like that to get it down another, you know, 30 points? Supposing that we'd say that person, we could get them to 150. Would that make a big difference in their risk of heart disease?
Here's where the breakdown of your cholesterol would make a significant difference. If that person's good cholesterol level was relatively high and their bad cholesterol level relatively low and their total was 180, I would say they're probably fine. You pointed out the fact that there are other risk factors that go into making up one's cardiovascular risk besides cholesterol, and you mentioned some of them in terms of weight, blood pressure, smoking, exercise habits. We need to throw in diabetes, and you also mentioned family history. Okay. So cholesterol is not the entire story, but it is a significant piece. Ideally, what you'd like to do is get your good cholesterol to be as good as you can and your bad cholesterol to be as low as you can. And the basic ways to do that are with attention to diet, and as you mentioned, exercise helps that balance between the two as well. And then, fortunately, for individuals who aren't able to achieve the ideal, the medications that are currently available are quite effective and have been very well tolerated and generally safe as well.
Our guest here on Focus 580 in the second hour, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic. And we're open to whatever questions you may have. Certainly, if we're talking here a little bit about the whole cholesterol and heart disease issue, if you have questions about that, that's fine. But anything else that's on your mind, just give us a call, and I know the doctor will be happy to advise you. We always, on these programs, caution people that we can't diagnose over the phone, but we do these shows to try and add to your general store of knowledge on health, and I know that the doctor will try his best to answer your question. So 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll start with Eureka and a caller here, line number four.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, continuing on the nutrition line, I don't know when your next nutritionist is going to be on, so I'll just pose this to the doctor.
Sure.
I saw where it said that this has to do with the comparison of white sugar and white bread, and it said that I understand how the white sugar could tend to increase your insulin output, and then that affects your appetite. But what I'm wondering about is on the white bread. You care to comment? See, it seems to me there isn't much difference between white bread and whole wheat bread, except for the fiber that's in the whole wheat bread. But do you care to comment about how desirability or not of white bread?
Well, white bread would probably be the quintessential American staple, and is somewhat problematic in that, as you pointed out, one of the major differences between it and whole wheat is just that, the amount of fiber. The fiber itself tends to decrease the body's absorption of cholesterol. And one of the ways in which elevated cholesterols are often treated dietarily is to add more fiber to the diet because it physically binds in the intestinal tract and helps prevent its absorption. So that in and of itself right there is probably a good reason to switch to something containing more fiber. In general, more fiber allows your intestinal tract to function more comfortably and easily, and that's another fairly common problem in the United States due to its relatively low residue diet. The more processed foods become, generally the less dietary fiber they have, and really the American diet should have more fiber in it for its general health benefits.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next caller is in Bloomington, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Doctor, is there a diuretic that can be taken on an as-needed basis rather than on a regular daily basis?
Any medication can potentially be taken on an intermittent basis if it's not required to be taken daily. I'm not quite sure I know why you're taking a diuretic.
I'll explain. When I'm on my feet quite a lot, usually my legs swell.
Mm-hmm.
But ordinarily, if I'm lying down enough, have enough time that I'm lying down, they will go down by themselves. In other words, if gravity does that.
That's right. And that usually relates to, as people commonly refer to them, varicose veins.
With time,
just due to gravity, the veins tend to become a little bit more stretched and dilated. They tend to leak fluid, as you say, just due to gravity. And in most instances, this is considered a fairly normal occurrence. If it's really a problem for you, on a short-term basis, the use of a diuretic is temporarily helpful. It's not going to change the nature of your veins or the law of gravity.
Can be used just on an as-needed basis, then, is that?
Yes, but probably the best thing that you could do is minimize the amount of salt in your diet so that you're not retaining fluid.
Salt at all.
Good. Make sure that your own fluid intake stays up. But this is a situation where a good pair of surgical support hose, if you put them on first thing in the morning, would probably help prevent the accumulation of fluid that you're getting over the day.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And would the hose just sort of tend to compress the...
It's simply mechanical compression to help prevent fluid from leaking out and pooling.
Uh-huh.
Basically, the fluid in your legs is pumped back out through the mechanical action of the muscles around the veins. And the support hose basically help facilitate that process.
And is there anything that you can do in terms of exercise that can help?
Well, in terms of just walking, as the muscles of the leg contract, they will indeed try and pump the blood back up through the veins, but you're also, when you're upright, then have the law of gravity in effect, and it just depends on the balance between those two.
Okay. We'll continue, and we have a caller next in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if you can tell me, in light of the first discussion, have the cholesterol and triglycerides specifically, have recommendations changed for levels of triglycerides in the blood?
I would have to go back and look. I don't think that they have changed significantly. Triglyceride levels are less of a cardiovascular risk than cholesterol. Triglycerides tend to be more of a problem in individuals who have diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the lipids or blood fats in the system, the cholesterol is typically in our diet in the form of red meats, the things that you think of as being fatty. Frying things tends to add cholesterol. Triglycerides typically come from what we would characterize as sweets, the cookies and the cakes, and also alcohol. Alcohol can be a very significant source of triglycerides.
Okay.
But those are the two major dietary sources of triglycerides, and I don't believe the recommendations there have changed much.
Okay. Would you consider high triglyceride levels to be an additional risk factor in terms of someone who's borderline on the cholesterol levels, and particularly given the new guidelines?
Yes. And in those particular instances, looking closely to make sure that there's not a diabetic state attached to it would be important as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. And somebody else right here, southeastern Illinois, line three. Hello.
Yes, this wasn't my original question, but all the talk about cholesterol, it's my impression, and I may be wrong, that the drug companies would like to see anti-cholesterol drugs become a standard part of the American diet, with more or less everybody taking them. And local pharmacist has made the remark that all drugs have side effects. I wondered, what are the side effects for anti-cholesterol drugs, and what would be your viewpoint about everybody taking them just as a sort of a standard, the way you take an aspirin a day to avoid heart attack?
Well, I think if the average American isn't going to change their diet and they want to lower their cholesterol, then medication is probably going to be necessary to do that. The newer class of drugs referred to as statins have been very effective. I think they have been generally very safe. Most of the cholesterol-lowering medications have their primary mode of action in the liver, so you need to be careful with individuals who already have pre-existing liver disease or who are on other medications that are metabolized in the liver. But the number of people who have to stop taking the medication because of side effects is really quite low.
That's so?
Yes.
So there really are, any side effects are minimum. I think there was a report this week, and I don't know who put out the report or what their basis for it was, but that the obese have more health problems than smokers, heavy drinkers, or the poor. I think if I were Pepperidge Farms or Haagen-Dazs, I would increase my liability insurance while I could. But the question that I was asking about something else, I think I heard it on NPR. They were talking about, it was the Illinois News, and they were talking about a law that was either in process, in the legislative process, or had been passed, and I don't remember that. But there are now procedures when somebody is in a hospital to leave instructions that the patient does not want to be resuscitated. But this was a law that they were either working on or had passed in Illinois about giving such instructions for ambulances. And I wondered if you knew anything about that and what would be the procedure for something like that.
I don't believe that I'm familiar with any specific law recently under consideration. The general topic is a good one, and I think patients should communicate with their physicians and especially with their family about what their wishes are in certain medical situations. You can designate that if you have a terminal illness that you don't wish to be resuscitated. You can also delegate to anyone that you choose your health care power of attorney. Hopefully you choose someone who will follow, who knows and will follow your general wishes as to how you would be want to be treated in a situation where you were unable to communicate those decisions yourself.
Well, I was thinking, I live alone, and I had an episode, it's been, I guess, maybe 2 or 3 months or so, where I an antibiotic, after the nurse had left, I had swelling in my mouth, and half of my tongue swelled, and my lip and the inside gum on the one side. It didn't amount to anything. But if it had been in my throat rather than up in my mouth, it could have been could have been life threatening. People said, phone an ambulance. Well, I was thinking, if you phoned an ambulance, and when they got here, you were unconscious, how would they have any way of knowing how long you had been unconscious and whether you had been unconscious long enough to do brain damage and whether or not you wanted to be resuscitated. I mean,
there is no way for them to know that. And
they automatically resuscitate?
That's exactly right. The basic underlying assumption is that if you called an ambulance, you want all of the medical attention that they can provide.
Yeah.
Now, if you just say, for example, are a hospice patient, you have cancer, you're terminal, you're at home, you become unresponsive, and you know a neighbor unwittingly calls an ambulance. If you have good documentation at home with your physician, with your family that says, I'm terminal, I don't want to be resuscitated, and that paperwork is available to the ambulance personnel when they arrive,
yeah,
they won't do all of the things that they normally do. But in the absence of that, they're basically ethically responsible to go ahead and do any and all resuscitative measures that they can.
Okay, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for the call. We are midway through here, this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's family practice physician at Carl Clinic, and every once in a while he's here, we do the show. We just call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that his experience is general and broad-based and deals with a lot of different things in his practice. And if you have a question, can be about yourself, can be about your children, whatever is on your mind health-wise, you are welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long distance, use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Next caller in line is in Indiana, in Crawfordsville, Indiana, line 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a piece of information for the man who just now spoke about his concern about do not resuscitate orders and the lack of. There's a service in California that a good many physicians are using these days called Medic Alert. It lets a person like me wear a bracelet. The back of the emblem indicates that I have a do not resuscitate order and certain illnesses that I have, with an 800 number that the EMTs or the doctor can call. I don't know whether the service works. I haven't had to use it. But I do know that, as I say, a good many doctors are using it now, and it's the first immediate message to EMTs of where I stand.
That particular company has been around for a long time, and I actually am familiar with them, but I didn't know that they were now doing documentation for do not resuscitate. The most common reason people have worn the Medic Alert bracelets is if they have a significant allergy to a medication, and if they were, you know, essentially unconscious and unable to speak for themselves, there's some readily available medical information, as you say, on the back of the bracelet. But the information about the resuscitation orders is new to me, and I thank
it's
you for that information.
It's a new service from Medic Alert. They also couple that with a service for a registry of living wills and the like. A person who needs to be and find out whether or not a patient has a living will can call that repository and get the information if it's a legitimate exchange.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Is that something that you, when you subscribe to this service, you pay a one-time fee? Is there an ongoing fee? How do they charge for that?
There's a one-time fee for signing up with Medic Alert. There's a $20 a year fee for the repository of living wills and such. Hmm. There's a one-time fee for the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate order.
Okay. Well, that's good to know that information.
Right. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Anybody else? You have questions? You can give us a call, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL.
The other common reason people use Medic Alert bracelets are diabetic patients who may indeed be found unconscious, and that may simply represent low blood sugar. And somebody who can look at their bracelet and recognize what the problem is can then have an opportunity to treat those patients before they get too far gone.
I think now that there's greater level of knowledge about things like living wills and durable power of attorney for health care. People's spouses have that for each other. Sometimes people, you know, their kids are appointed so they can look after them if they can't say what they want. People now, I think many of them do have these orders that say they don't want heroic measures taken if it looks like they're going to die. But I suspect that a lot of people worry that their wishes won't, somewhere along the line, their wishes won't be complied with, or that the doctor would say to them, yes, of course, this is what you want, but then the doctor might do something else if that person wasn't able to speak for themselves. Can people be fairly sure that if they've really done all the things that are required and they've complied with whatever the laws are and everybody knows about it, their family knows about it, their doctors know about it, that then what they want to happen will happen, or what they don't want to happen won't happen?
It basically boils down to, in a situation where a patient is unable to communicate for themselves, relying on whatever other information is available to glean some idea of what they would have wanted done in that situation. And the vast majority of times, that's going to be a discussion with the rest of the family. And this is sometimes difficult for the physician, because it's not unusual to have half the family say, do everything for dear old dad, and the other half the family say, well, you know, he didn't really want to be on that life support system, and we don't think you should. That's a very awkward situation to be in. It will basically come down to whoever holds the healthcare power of attorney in that particular situation has the final legal decision-making capability. And that's what will happen. Now, if it's so acrimonious amongst the family that the physician is uncomfortable with that, one of the resources that we have available in the hospital setting is we have an ethics committee that we can request a consultation from. They will come in and, again, review all of the information, talk with all the people involved, and try and come up with some suggestions as to how the situation might be handled. But it's not uncommon for somebody in the family to be unhappy with the decision.
And as a physician, then, if you were in a position like that, would the first thing you would do is say to the family, say, look, you folks, you got to go talk about this. I'll do what you decide you want to do, but first, you among yourselves have to decide what the family wants to do,
and this is one of those situations where it's easier if the physician and the patient have had an ongoing relationship. The physician knows the patient's medical condition and knows the patient's wishes, especially if they've been reduced to writing and are part of the medical record. It becomes much easier in that particular setting for the physician to say, this is what the patient would have wanted.
Okay, well, let's keep going here. We have another caller. Urbana, line one.
I know you didn't plan on having this be an end-of-life discussion, but I wanted to say that the Bill Moyers program series that was on television on death and dying and end-of-life decisions and how various people had handled that, I thought was very, very helpful in terms of giving you some realistic ideas about what kinds of things people face in the process, long process of dying for some people.
I'm sorry, I missed that particular program. Were there some particular points that you thought would be helpful to share?
Well, they covered quite a few different people's lives. One was a doctor who was dying, and ultimately he dispensed with a living will, I think, and just gave his wife power of attorney. And talked with her as things progressed about, and as individual decisions were coming up about what his wishes were, and as he began to get clearer ideas of what the end might be like for him, and tried to bolster her to be willing to make those decisions for him when he could no longer do that. There was another woman whose mother had a living will, and it turned out to be inadequate, but the daughter was still pleased that it was there because it gave her some direction. She kind of muddled through. I can't remember all the details, but it was like a 3 or 4 night series, and I wouldn't be surprised if the local libraries got them in as videotapes. I don't know if they're available through the for ordering through the PBS home video setup or not, but I really recommend that people check it out because it does give you some clearer ideas of different situations that people might run into. But then there was also a program called Survivor MD on public television, and they were following various young doctors through their medical training and into their early practices. And one of the doctors said something very interesting. I think he was being an intern at this point, and he had a patient who he described, an elderly patient. He said, this woman is trying to die. And with her family's consent, he had given her morphine to ease her final days. And it ended up giving her an extra month of life, I think in part maybe because it helped ease her feeling, made her more comfortable, so she wasn't struggling with the pain. And that's one of the other things they talked about in the TV series was palliative care and how that can make it easier for people to have time to say their goodbyes because they're not fighting the pain and the discomfort, and so they can accomplish some of the leave-taking and the healing that some families need and this sort of thing. But this young doctor said, I think that people, just like we help people to be born, we should do a better job of helping people to die when they're ready to die. And I thought that was a really interesting way to look at it.
I think that's an excellent observation, and I believe that that would pretty much summarize the philosophy behind most hospice programs. People sometimes don't realize that hospice is available to any individual with a illness or condition that is expected to ultimately bring about the patient's death within, and again, these are only estimates, about 6 months' time. People always think of hospice and cancer, but in fact, we have utilized the hospice program for patients with end-stage heart disease, lung disease, other medical conditions that have nothing to do with cancer, at a point when the patient and their family are ready to say, I don't want more tests, I don't want more surgery, I don't want more experimental drugs of any sort. I'm at a point where I realize that my condition is indeed terminal, and I would like the focus to be on the quality of my remaining days. And I think you summarized that very well.
Yeah, I really recommend it. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll continue. We have some other local calls. Also Urbana, line number 2. There next. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question. I twisted my ankle and or sprained it. I don't know. I've never done either of those things before. And it was like 5 weeks ago. It's still sore and maybe it's still a little bit swollen. I put ice on it right afterwards. And it's much, much better, but I'm still kind of hobbling around a bit, and I've never done this before, so I was just kind of wondering, is it normal for 5 weeks later for it to still be stiff? It's especially stiff after I've been off of it for a while, and sore, and is there anything I could do to help hurry things along, and or should I go in and get it x-rayed?
Well, if you'll hold your foot up to the radio there, I'll take a look. Actually, you described a fairly common situation, and it's going to be sort of tough to sort it out. The normal sprain takes about 4 to 6 weeks to really heal well.
Okay.
And that assumes that you've been taking good care of it, which means at least initially you're staying off of it, you're elevating it, you're icing it, you're using some anti-inflammatory agents to take down the swelling and discomfort, and you're not doing anything physically that's going to stress something that's already been injured. So there are people who have a relatively minor sprain who continue to run around on their foot and ankle and then wonder why it's not getting better.
Uh-huh.
You may be in that category. On the other hand, there are indeed people who say, oh, I just sprained it, but several weeks later they're saying, well, you know, it's still tender, it's still swollen, and they indeed have a fracture. And the only way you're going to be able to sort those two out is to get an X-ray.
So you can't tell whether you have a fracture by whether or not you can move it or whatever?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but you're out far enough that if you're still having trouble, it's probably worth having it looked at.
Okay. I had also heard that once you do something like this, you can end up getting arthritis in that joint. Is that true?
Fractures that involve the joint surface, if they don't heal well, are more prone than to go on and develop arthritic change in that joint.
Yeah.
But a typical ankle sprain, no, that's not true.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And another caller here, also Urbana, line 3. Hello. The caller there on line 3, yes.
You mentioned 5 minutes ago or so something about going to an ethics committee if you were in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you should warn people that they might charge you serious amounts of money for that.
I'm not aware of what the charge for that is, but I'm assuming that it's a medical consultation like any other for which there would be a charge.
Well, it's going to be a huge charge because they're going to have a bunch of different people on the committee. So I don't think you should mention it lightly because people might take your advice and then go, hey, you cost me thousands of dollars for them to say they didn't know what to do.
All right.
I mean, I'm serious. These people can charge you a huge amount of money for that kind of committee and never tell you anything you didn't already know.
Well, they're usually brought into situations where otherwise people aren't agreeing on what should be done.
Yeah, but they're very cautious about saying anything when you don't agree. They'll go around and around and around trying to make you say you agree without ever giving you any suggestions that are worthwhile. They talk too much like lawyers and not enough like doctors.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Okay.
Always ask what it costs.
Yeah, very, very much so.
All right.
They go in there and say, we want to do more tests. You know, and they always say that. And all of a sudden, you can find out that something that was going to cost you, you know, $100 or $200 is going to cost you thousands. And it could be something trivial like kidney stones. And they don't need to do any tests to find out more about that. No, they even admitted to me after the whole thing that they had no record of anybody ever dying of kidney stones.
So this sounds like this comes out of a personal experience.
Well, everything that I know is personal experience. I'm not a doctor.
Okay. Well, we'll go back to the other advice is always ask what it costs.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Thank you. We've got about 10 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580, and we're inviting your healthcare questions. We do this every couple months with Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic, and we call these shows Talk to the Family Doctor because that's kind of the idea. Whatever question you have about your health, could be for you, for a family member, a child, a grown-up, whatever's on your mind, you can call us in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Something that just occurred to me way back at the beginning of the program, we may have talked about this before. I think that there's a lot of confusion. People have a lot of confusion about sugar. And particularly people have this idea that we've been told that refined sugars, that white stuff that's in the sugar ball is bad, and that we ought to try and minimize the amount of that in our diet. And but then, of course, we're also told that we should be eating more fruits and vegetables. So we have this idea that eating a candy bar is not a good thing, but you can eat an apple or a bunch of grapes, and that's good. And I think there's confusion because I kind of think that that's sort of all the same, that sugar is sugar within some range of discussion. Now, you can straighten me out here. Really, is there very much difference between eating a Snickers and eating
an apple?
An apple.
Yeah. In the sense that the simple sugars are very rapidly metabolized, absorbed, and get into your bloodstream very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. The sugar that's contained in fruit is in a more complex form, takes longer to digest, gets into your system slower, and does not produce nearly the insulin response that the simple straight sugars do. Now, calorically, you're correct. You know, if you have 100 calories worth of a Snicker bar and 100 calories worth of an apple, it's still 100 calories. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that people sometimes forget. I'll have my diabetic patients come in and they say, you know, I cut out all the cookies and the cakes and I'm just eating fruit. And you find out that they're eating 5,000 calories worth of fruit every day. And it's still 5,000 calories. And you still have to process that. And, you know, it ends up somewhere. So even, as they say, too much of a good thing can be bad for you. But taken as a whole, what you would prefer for your system are foods that are more slowly metabolized, get into your system in a more controlled manner, as opposed to the simple sugar, which just basically goes straight in and generates an intense insulin response.
Okay, so better off with the apple.
Yes.
All right. To some other callers here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, first, I appreciate you being on the radio and stuff. My main fear is I might have to switch insurance soon, so any little problem I have, I don't want to go to my doctor and create a pre-existing condition that after I switch insurances, I won't be able to get treated. But nonetheless, I got another problem kind of with the ankle. And it's like I twisted it from kind of like moving it from the inside to the outside, and I get a sharp pain that kind of runs up the leg just about maybe 3 inches if I twist it too far that way. And I was wondering, is that more of a sprain or is that something with a tendon?
Well, the sprain is an injury involving the tendon.
Oh, really?
That's a partial separation of the anchoring structures within the tendon itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about essentially the same thing.
Okay. And so the treatment would be like for that lady you talked to earlier, just kind of keep off of it and wait 6 weeks or so and see if it gets better?
Yes. Now, there are some rehabilitation type exercises that you can do for your ankle that are should be painless and won't aggravate anything.
Okay.
If you are sitting and you took your foot and you attempted to draw the alphabet with your foot, mm-hmm. like you were going to write with a pen between your toes,
mm-hmm.
If you run through the entire alphabet with your foot and your ankle, you have given it a nice, gentle range of motion and strengthening exercise. And this is something that you can do, you know, whenever you just happen to be sitting around, mm-hmm. and is often quite useful in getting the ankle back in shape.
Okay. All right, then. Thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll do one more here. This person is in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that I am having problem with the sciatic nerve. It started out approximately 2 weeks ago with just some generalized pain in my lower back, but it has gravitated now to the very definitely to the left side of my posterior and kind of down my leg, and it is just getting... It seems to be getting progressively worse, and it is so painful. I have trouble sleeping, and I it hurts to walk. It's just incredible how bad it hurts to walk. And if does this sound like sciatic nerve to you? And what do you do for that? Do you work it out? Do you walk, or do you try to stay off of it?
Actually, you give a pretty good description of discomfort that can indeed be consistent with sciatica, which is the general term used to describe a situation where pressure on the nerve as it comes out of your low back and runs down into your leg produces that discomfort, just as you describe. It goes down the buttock, down the back of the leg, and in some instances will go below the knee all the way to the foot. This can sometimes be associated with numbness or tingling or weakness in the leg.
No.
That's good. Any change in bowel or bladder
function? No.
That's good, too. And this wasn't the result of any injury that you recall?
No.
Okay.
It maybe just increased physical work out in the yard or something mm-hmm. like that, but I don't remember any particular event.
Okay. The vast majority of these do indeed get better on their own, but people are disappointed to find that instead of it being a couple of weeks, it's usually a couple of months before they get better. But basically, time and anti-inflammatory agents, the ibuprofen, naproxen-type medications are reasonable for discomfort. People have used muscle relaxants and ice and heat and massage and physical therapy. You're basically doing anything you can to simply make it feel better while you wait for it to heal up. Now, people who have ongoing leg pain that doesn't resolve after a few months may indeed be a surgical candidate to have the pressure physically removed from their spine by an operation. But those are really the exceptions.
So do you recommend just continue with regular activity then?
Probably one of the best exercises you can do for your back is to simply walk.
Okay.
Now, any additional bending or lifting that you're doing is going to be a problem, and I would probably try and keep that to a minimum.
Well, thank you so much for your help. This has been very informative.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks to everyone who called. We will leave it at that for this time around with our thanks to our guest, Jeff Swearingen. He's family practice doctor from Carl Clinic, and in a couple of months, we'll do it again. Thank you.
Thank you, David.